We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by Richard Overy, who is a professor at the University of Exeter. Also, we've written and edited more than 30 books, including those books you probably are familiar with, While the Allies Won, Russia's War, The Twilight Years, 1939, and The Bomb and the Bombed. This latest book that we're here to discuss today is entitled Blood and Ruins, The Last Imperial War, 1931 to 1945. It is getting rave reviews everywhere from the New York Times to the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for joining us, Richard.
Thank you.
Yes, of course. So I want to start just by asking, this particular book has been described as comprehensive, and I think certainly it's intended to be. So why was it that you felt this particular book, after having written so many histories of this time period, why was it you felt you had to write this book in particular?
Well, that's a good question. I have written a lot on the Second World War already, although I've never written a really comprehensive book on the Second World War. And I think in the last 20 years, so much more has been written about the war. We know so much more about the war. But I wanted to write a book which said something a bit different. I chose really this imperial framework, seeing the Second World War as the last stage of a 500-year history of European imperialism. And if you see the war that way, you ask very different sorts of questions and you arrive, I think, at some very different answers.
Mm. And that is fascinating because the book also is very global and talks about imperialism, not just in Europe, but in that time period, sort of around the world. And I guess the question then that I wanted to ask you is, what did World War II end when it came to imperialism globally? And I guess sort of the various competitions that had taken place for hundreds of years around the world.
Well, I mean, it is a global history, and I made a big effort to include the war in Asia, which often gets a kind of sidelined in most general histories of the Second World War. I trace really the last, if you like, the dying moments of the imperial order from the early 1930s onwards, and it really comes to an end in the early 1960s when the colonial empires are finally wound up. Now, one might well argue that there's a lot of imperialism around ever since, even in Ukraine today. But to me, this was a particular moment. The world had been governed by imperialism of one kind or another for a long period of time. It had a last fling in the 1930s and 40s with the Germans, the Italians, and the Japanese. But after that, that kind of territorial imperialism unraveled and was replaced by what we know today, a world of nation states.
Is there a sense in which the time between World War I and World War II, and actually even that first part of the 20th century, was kind of, there was a transition process happening from imperialism to the nation state in that, what Europe looked like at the time is different than it looks today, but there was already the sort of nation state global trend, at least, or Europe trend, it was already sort of materializing, was it not?
It was, yes. And at the end of the First World War, a lot of people worldwide thought that this was a war to liberate people, allow them to establish their own nations, whether it was in Korea or in India or wherever, Egypt. It was a period of transition. In Europe, the old dynastic empires were broken up and new states introduced. But that invited Germany to think about reconquering a new kind of empire in Eastern Europe. So it was a mixed period. The big paradox is that the two countries that dominated the interwar period, Britain and France, two huge global empires, kept talking about democracy and self-determination, and they were happy that European states had become, had been formed at the end of the First World War, but they were not going to offer that to their subject peoples. And that paradox played a very important part, actually, in interwar years, because it meant that the Germans, the Japanese, the Italians all looked at the British and French and said, hey, wait a minute, you're not really countries committed to internationalism and democracy. You're territorial empires, so why don't we have one too?
There's a lot written, and a lot of people have talked about the correlation between, I guess, technology and democracy. That is, you know, and you can get into Fukuyama and all of that good stuff at the end of the 20th century. But I wonder if there's a correlation between, in your mind, technologies that were emergent, you know, even radio, photography, the ease of travel, whether it's by boat or by plane, that had come to pass in this part of world history. How did that perhaps play into the end of imperialism, if you think it did at all?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, what is clear is that what we now take for granted, the kind of global internationalism, air travel, of course, is the best example, perhaps, was on the rise in the 1920s and 1930s. And there were lots of people who thought that the future now was going to be, you know, capitalist economies and so on, modern technology, etc. And those technologies were mobilized by the new imperial states, Germany, Japan, and Italy, and exploited in order to justify the nature of their imperialism. But after 1945, you know, the globalization of technology, economic globalization, which had been interrupted really by the First World War, took off again. So again, the interwar years really are a period of transition, a mixed period, a paradoxical period. And that's why I talked in my book, The Twilight Years, but this was a strange period globally between an optimistic pre-1914 and then post-1945, the development of the world we know now.
Yeah, and it also, I guess people don't necessarily think about nuclear technology or atomic technology as technology. I think it's really not that distant history, but I suppose maybe it feels like it to some people. And then the establishment of this post-World War II order. You know, there's a lot of conversation right now about NATO, for instance, and the United Nations. Do you see these as sort of a reaction to the technology that shocked the world and ended, you know, millions of lives at the end of World War II, that is atomic weaponry, and that, you know, to some extent you have to establish these global organizations in order to deal with the emergence of what is perhaps the most consequential invention in human history?
No, well, indeed, yeah. I mean, that certainly did help to shape the post-war order. The Cold War was about two superpowers, and no other power could match them. And they developed huge nuclear arsenals and so on. And that dictated the shape of the geopolitical order. But in fact, despite all the wars still being fought in Asia or in Africa, etc., the Cold War was actually a remarkably stable period, really, between the Soviet Union and the United States, actually much more stable now than the 2020s. Everybody talked about deterrence and, you know, what the threat really meant, etc. But deterrence did work, really. I mean, you know, in the shadow of a nuclear threat, the modern nation-state order was constructed, a global economy that functioned well was constructed, in defiance, in a sense, of the existence of this terrible weapon.
And again, this is a timely conversation. So I'm sure many of your conversations about this book have been, given the release's correlation with what's the land war in Europe that has emerged. But one thing I wanted to ask is, there is something in the history of World War II, of course, and this is all war, but this particular war, the crimes and the atrocities, the just sort of stomach churning reality of what was happening, for those years. As we think about what we're seeing play out in our televisions right now, it's shocking to a lot of people around the world, but certainly not without precedent. What can you tell us? I know this is a huge question, and you've written many books on the topic itself, but about what this war really looked like and sort of shocking the consciences of the world.
Well, there's another paradox there, I think, because certainly for the West, the war has always been seen as the good war. It was a war that had to be won against militarism and fascism. It was a good war, and it was fought by democratic states on democratic principles and so on. And the idea that this was a war that actually involved huge levels of crime and atrocity. And many of the crimes, you know, perpetrated, in fact, by the Western Alliance, almost all of them perpetrated by the Soviet Union during the course of the war. And what I've tried to do, I think, in the book is not to say, well, you know, they were all wrong, but just simply we need to get some sense of what war does. And it makes people go off the rails morally. And we can see that today in Ukraine, and in Ukraine for no reason, really. But in the Second World War, deep hatreds, German hatred of communism, Japanese hatred of the Americans and the Chinese and so on, which generated what I've called in the book a kind of toxic culture, certainly in those two cases, where atrocity simply became routine. In fact, you didn't question it, and nobody stopped you doing it. And I think one of the things I hope the book does actually is just bring people up short and say, well, hey, wait a minute, it was a good war, but actually it was a dirty war as well.
Yeah, it is interesting, especially as somebody who went through the American school system, the way that the war is taught. I mean, we have that here with the way our Civil War is taught in different regions of the country, but in different regions of the world, this particular war, I think, is taught very differently as well. And I'm sure you have seen that in your years of scholarship of it.
It certainly is. I mean, in Japan, it's taught very, very differently. There's still a kind of Japanese nationalist response, really, which is, you know, we were justified in, you know, everybody else had an empire, why shouldn't we have an empire? And the things that Japan is supposed to have done in China, well, they're all much exaggerated, etc. And the Americans shouldn't have dropped the atomic bomb, which was a terrible atrocity. And so the way in which the war is taught in Japan is a distortion of the way we think about it. In the Soviet Union, I mean, the war, you know, the Soviet Union did a lot of not very nice things in the late 1930s and early 1940s and after 1945. But the war is seen as somehow a virtuous war. It's a moment in which the Soviet Union really justified its existence. And that war has played a very important part in Soviet and now Russian identity. It's interesting that Putin, again, is constantly referring back to the Second World War, seeing the Ukrainians as Nazis and so on. And I think it would be a very good idea, really, if leaders could be made to sit down around a table with a bunch of annoying academics and, you know, be told a little bit of truth.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask you about Putin's repeated invocation of the denazification and the liberation of Ukraine. It's interesting, and it does seem to be a very clear attempt to evoke the sentiments there. And I remember, actually, I saw this in a Vice documentary. A woman was talking to her niece in Ukraine, but she was in Russia, and she said, "You have been told everything wrong. This is a liberation of Ukraine from Nazis." And it was so sincerely, such a sincerely held belief. Could you give us some context as a historian of this time period of why Putin is so, I think, fixated on the denazification line?
Well, I mean, it is coming back to what I said just now. I think that for the Russians today, just as it was for the Soviet population, the war played a supremely important part. I mean, the Soviet Union sacrificed huge numbers of people in the Second World War. 27 million is the number we normally count. And it's deeply embedded in Russian popular memory and deeply embedded in Russian culture. And I think that for Putin, it's quite an easy thing to conjure up. You immediately get the people on your side. You immediately make the Ukrainians into a particular kind of enemy. And it's very important in wars of aggression that you make the people you're fighting against into some kind of monster, like Hitler, you know, told the Germans that the Poles were barbarians. You know, here's Putin telling the Russians that the Ukrainians are all Nazis. Of course, it's nonsense. But you're not going to tell your ordinary Russian that it's nonsense, because they listen to Russian propaganda and they hear Putin's point of view. I think it's a very dangerous invocation, because it's going to allow the Russians to do a great many very unpleasant things in Ukraine, and to justify it simply by a crude analogy with the past. What Putin ought to have been alive to, I think, was the performance of the Red Army in the early years of the Second World War, because it's quite striking that they seem to have learned almost nothing between 1941 and 2022.
Can you elaborate on that point? Because that's a really interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the way in which they're using their armor, it's quite extraordinary. The Ukrainians can ambush the armor. I think only this morning they destroyed 8 tanks in a single attack. The armor is not being protected properly. They've created these armor brigades, but there's not enough infantry and supporting artillery and so on. They're filing in line across roads where you really have little defense. Now, the Germans didn't fight like that in 1941. They fought with large integrated panzer divisions. They were multi-arm. Tanks were there, but there were plenty of other things as well. And that was the only way tanks could work. And I think the fact that the Russians have lost so many tanks is that they just need to go back and read the manuals of the Second World War.
Do you think Putin, and there's debate about this, he has some type of quote where he says, you know, anybody who doesn't miss the Soviet Union is a fool, but anybody who doesn't have a heart, but anybody who wants the Soviet Union to return is a fool. Mm. And a lot of people sort of try to psychoanalyze Vladimir Putin and, you know, say, does he want to be Stalin or does he want to be a czar? Imperial Russia obviously has a rich history, but where do you think Putin sees himself in the history of Russia, at least, you know, the last 600 or so years?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult. Does he want to be Stalin? I mean, he's doing some pretty Stalinist things at times. I mean, I think that if we look at the long Russian past, of course, I mean, there's an extraordinary tradition of a strong leader who's able to persuade the Russian people that he's right and to do what he wants them to do. And I think, that Putin has grown into this role slowly. Nobody would have thought in, year 2000 that this would be a virtual dictator launching aggressive war in the 2020s. But I think he will see himself in, the future Russian history books as something of the hero, just as, he's very keen that nobody cast any aspersion on Stalin. Stalin's reputation is to be protected. And in Russia now, people who say the wrong thing about Stalin in the late 1930s or the Nazi-Soviet pact and so on end up in prison.
Yeah. Putin is such an interesting character because, again, it does feel like some of this history is so far in our past, but it really isn't. I mean, he's doing this within, 100 years of the end of World War II. And in some ways, I guess maybe is it as though we just had a brief intermission in, this moment in history?
Well, I hope it's not a brief intermission. I
yes.
hope that we can go back and reestablish some kind of global order again once the dust has settled in 2, 3, 4 years' time. So I hope it's not just an intermission. But it is interesting what you're saying. We feel suddenly closer to the Second World War again than we did before the invasion started. And for anybody who knows about the Second World War, all the echoes are there, the Battle for Kharkov. Well, Kharkov was fought over 3 times by the Germans and the Russians and utterly destroyed, as it is being utterly destroyed today. You think about the claim that the Russian troops are not doing anything. It's like Stalin's insistence that the Russians blamed the Germans for Katyn and the murder of the Polish officers and so on. Suddenly the Second World War feels very near again, but it isn't near. I mean, there's been an awful lot happening. The geopolitical order is very different. And I think part of Putin's problem is that the Russians didn't any longer seem to have a role in that geopolitical order. What was their role? Are they Asian? Are they European? What did they do with the lost power of the Soviet Union? What did they do with the huge China on their frontier? And I think that in some respects, what Putin is doing is just, stamping his foot and saying, here's Russia, and we're going to do what we want to do, and what are you going to do about it? I think he's probably shocked at what the West has actually decided to do about it.
Yeah, and it seems right now a lot of people are revisiting, or I think learning for the first time, about the role that the land we know as Ukraine and has been a sovereign country now played in that war. And you, of course, just touched on it. The New York Times review of your book talks about, they say, to understand the bombing of Kyiv and the destruction of Mariupol, read up on the annihilationist sieges of Leningrad and Stalingrad. You know, for people who aren't familiar with that history, what do they mean by that? And, you know, what can we learn from the role Ukraine played in World War II?
Yeah, well, Ukraine, I mean, has the misfortune of being raked over by war, first of all, in the end of the First World War, then raked over by the Bolshevik system in the 1920s and 30s, then raked over again by the Germans and then the returning Russians during the Second World War. I mean, it is an awful history. I mean, I get a terrible sense, in a way, of the phlegmatic response of many Ukrainians to their crisis today. I think for many of them, this is what happens to Ukraine. And anybody old enough to remember it will know that it's something that happened to Ukraine 80 years ago. Many of them might remember that it happened to Ukraine just over 100 years ago, too. Ukraine is, it's in the middle. It's between the Europe that so many Russians in the previous centuries have wanted to be and Asia, if you like, because Russia is predominantly an Asian country. And it's their misfortune that, you know, whenever violence has been unleashed in the last 100 years, they've been in the wrong place.
My last Ukraine-related question is the big one that the New York Times review raises, which is that, you know, they say something to the effect of it's the subtitle of the book, The Last Imperial War May Now Feel Premature, something to that that extent, given the fact that Putin is waging what the reviewer sees as an imperial war against Ukraine. Is that an accurate, do you think it's fair to suggest it was premature to say that this is the last, that World War II was the last imperial war now that Putin seems to be attempting to revive it? Or do you think it's so sort of obvious that he's an outlier and an exception that it's the point stands?
Well, I have to confess that the title of the book in Britain is The Great Imperial War, not The Last Imperial War. It was changed for the American edition. And I could see as soon as it was, as soon as the change was made, that it was hostage to fortune. And of course, the war in Ukraine broke out just 2 months before it was published. I mean, it is the last imperial war in the sense in which I was talking about it, you know, the extension of European global power and so on, the seizing of territory, the colonialization of the world and so on. No, that's not what's happening now. And I don't think Putin is really an imperialist. I mean, Russia is a hegemonic power and wants to be a greater hegemonic power. And Putin wants to go down in the history books as you know, demonstrating that hegemony. But an imperial power? Well, I mean, you might ask me this question in a year's time with Russian forces in Finland and Lithuania, and I'll have to say you were right, but I hope not.
Mm-hmm. You said something really interesting at the beginning of our conversation, which was that even in the last 20 years, we have learned so much more about World War II. As a historian, can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean when you say that? Is it, you know, more, is it that, you know, this is just the natural process of time? Of course, you have more time to learn more about the time in the past, or is it also just that there are so many more first person accounts that have, you know, come to the surface? And if so, what are the big things that we've learned in the last, you know, couple of decades that shape our understanding of the conflict?
Well, quite a lot of historians use first-person accounts because, as everybody knows, veterans tend to talk about the war long, long afterwards, often in old age and so on. So there's a huge amount available, but you know, often that's not particularly reliable testimony. I mean, the important thing, I think, is, for example, the opening of the Russian archives in the 1990s. The opening up of Chinese archives in the last 10 or 15 years. Now, historians are actually now at last able to look at what was really happening inside the Soviet Union. And that's, you know, made a terrific difference. They're able to look at what was happening in China, Chiang Kai-shek's China, and the Japanese war there, which was, on the whole, something of a mystery even 20 years ago. People wrote about it. But the detail was broadly lacking. I mean, take one interesting example. Nobody's ever really talked much about the Chinese war economy. You know, where did they get their guns and tanks from? What do they do? How do they fight the war? Well, a very good book has been written about that, and it showed astonishingly that the Chinese produced almost nothing. They relied very much on First World War equipment that had been sent to them, on lend-lease aid, on really fighting the Japanese in a pretty primitive way. But we had no way of knowing that, really, until Chinese records became more generally available. So first of all, archives have opened up in places that we didn't expect them. I think the second thing is that historians of later generation are much more critical of the war history. They're not prepared to take the myths. And for the Western war effort, Churchill, Roosevelt and so on, all of these things have now got to be examined a bit more closely. And the more we examine them, the better history we're writing. But we're also writing, a different history. Just give one more example, is the Holocaust. The kind of popular assumption that the West fought the Second World War on behalf of the Jews. I mean, there are many younger people at school who think that, in fact, but nothing could be further from the truth. Once we get stuck into the archives and find how the British and American governments really viewed the Jewish question, then we have to look at it in a very different light.
And again, that's a huge question, but as somebody who went through the American school system, that is 100% what my early impressions of the war were. In your ability to do this, this format as opposed to an entire book format, what should people know about how the British and American governments really did view, as you say, that question, which has been in the West and in America in particular, probably portrayed as so central to the Allies' fight?
Yes, no, I mean, good question. The real problem was that neither the British government nor the American government wanted lots of Jews, refugee Jews, to come into the country. Roosevelt talked at first about perhaps setting up some kind of Jewish settlement in Alaska. The British thought about setting up a Jewish settlement in Madagascar or British Guiana, now Guyana, in South America. They just didn't want the Jews. And when it came to the Jews going to Palestine, which the British had allowed for some years in the interwar period, they clammed up completely. For them, the Jews were a problem because, they worried that public opinion would think they were being too pro-Semitic. And they also worried that would create an increasingly anti-Semitic sentiment among the wider public. So for all these reasons, they did, as we now know, almost nothing to save the Jews of Europe. Right at the end, some greater effort was made, but by then the German war effort was crumbling. But before that, they were just, they were cautious about doing anything too much, or to be seen to be doing anything too much on behalf of the Jews.
Yeah, that's... the way that it's taught is so different from the reality. And it reminds me actually that Madeleine Albright just passed away, somebody who was herself a refugee and a victim. And I wonder if this period of time, 2022, the pressure is on to start sort of recording any history from survivors, from people who lived through this conflict, from all sides of it. Does it feel as though this has kind of kicked into overdrive as we are really nearing the end of the lifespans of people who would have been, actually alive to witness this conflict again from any of its sides?
Well, the overwhelming majority of people who lived through and fought through the Second World War are dead now, of course. But with the Ukraine crisis today, what you have is instant history. I mean, this is very different from the Second World War, where everything was letters and correspondence and government archives and so on. Now there's a whole electronic archive, and it's difficult to see how that's going to be retrieved or used because we rely on it so much, but storing it or accessing it is not going to be an easy issue. But what it does mean is that we're close up to the war. in a way which publics were not close up to the Second World War. They had to wait till they get to the cinema, they saw Pathé News, they might see 10 minutes of information. But you know, most people in the Second World War had only a vague idea about what was going on. Might seem odd to us now, but now everybody knows what's going on in Ukraine. You put your computer on every single morning, and the stark details are all there in your face. And that ought to make a difference. It ought to make Putin think twice, actually, before doing the things that he's allowing his troops to do. But it does mean that this is, perhaps for the first time, a public war, really public war. What historians will make of that in 20, 30, 50 years' time, it's difficult to say. They'll have to use the evidence they have with great caution, I think. We're not going to have a pile of archives as you had before.
So here in the States, we think of Vietnam as, you know, the first television war, and that's sort of where our criticism of media's relationship with government and with war, that's kind of where our history seems to start. But of course, the history was very much alive and happening during the Second World War. And I'm curious if there's a way you could distill the Western media's influence on the outcome of the war. Is there a good way to explain that? There are full books on this, of course, but in the time we have, you know, how did the Western media basically influence the outcome of the war in either direction?
Well, I mean, the Western media, of course, was controlled, like all media in the Second World War. They could not say entirely what they wanted to say, and they would get rapped on the wrist if they said the wrong thing. Most people relied on newspapers and radio, and radio could be extremely unreliable. Spread in America, small radio stations spread all kinds of rumors during the course of the Second World War. But on the whole, they didn't really influence the course and outcome of the war, except to the extent that they tried to maintain public interest and enthusiasm, which often flagged in the Western countries. You know, 5 years of war, which, you know, for much of the time you don't think you're winning, it's quite difficult to keep up people's enthusiasm. And that's one of the jobs that the media tried to do, but not always with great success. I did a book some years ago, extract articles from New York Times during the course of the war. And it's interesting how much of the front page of New York Times was taken up with trivial, non-war things, and how much news in the United States had to be United States news and not global news. I think that's changed by today. But the media's role in the Second World War was, I would say, it was rather a muted one. It was more important, in fact, in places like Germany, where there was only one media and one voice and one story. And so Germans latched onto it, including, of course, isolating and destroying the Jews.
Hmm. Well, and I was actually just going to ask on that subject, as you were reviewing New York Times articles, what did American media coverage of, well, Western media coverage of, or Allied media coverage of the genocide, you know, how long did it take for that really to penetrate the media's consciousness and to make it in sort of a reputable and relatively accurate fashion into their coverage?
Well, it didn't, is the answer. In the States, the New York Times, which of course had Jewish owners, the Jewish owners were desperate not to flog the Jewish question because they worried about what their audience would think about it. And of course, people were skeptical of the news because it seemed so incomprehensible, so awful that they couldn't really believe the Germans were doing it. A popular historical image of the Holocaust really only emerges from the 1960s and 70s, long after the Second World War. At Nuremberg, the Jewish question was there, but it wasn't central at all to the war crimes trials. And there was not a great deal of public interest in it. It was really only in the 60s and 70s, typically with that television series, The Holocaust, which had a huge impact worldwide. For many people, it was the first time they really began to understand what had happened. And in the Second World War, it was difficult to believe it. It was hard to get reliable material. And anyway, newspapers didn't want to make a great deal of it.
It's amazing to think about that, especially given, as you say, the history as it unfolds now, it's immediate, it's instant. There's no real avoiding of it, unless it's happening in China, of course, where they're controlling the media, or in Russia. One final question. Do you have a novel or a movie, you probably get asked this a lot, that you think is most representative or a most compelling sort of fictional rendering of the real events of the Second World War?
Well, that's a very difficult question. I mean, my favorite Second World War movie is Casablanca. As it is,
that's a good one.
For many people. And as an historian, of course, Casablanca tells me a great deal about American propaganda and about the way the Western shape of the war and how they perceived it. And I think it's still, you know, it's still important as an historical document, I think, from that point of view. Other movies, well, I mean, you know, so much of the movie world about the Second World War is really about, you know, it's Schindler's List. It's, you know, some guy doing something heroic for a handful of Jews, or it's Saving Private Ryan. It's a personal story with a lot of drama. There are very few films that, for me, really capture that reality. Sophie's Choice is one. It might seem an odd film to single out, but Sophie's Choice and its relation to the Holocaust and the gradual unfolding of that truth is a remarkable film, I think.
That's a great answer. That is really interesting for the perspective of a historian. That is such a nuanced and patient movie, I suppose. Richard Overy, the book is Blood and Ruins. Again, you can get it out now. It's getting absolutely rave reviews. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
Faint voice of reason, and then it faded away.